Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Prasky. A new report details how well state policies support expecting and new parents. Grades were handed out, and the reviews for Kansas and Missouri weren't pretty. We'll talk about that new report from the National Partnership for Women and Families in our second half today. First, reporter Malcolm Garcia is back with us. Malcolm is a former Star reporter who made a name for himself covering social services and the plight of some of the city's poorest citizens. Now Malcolm is out with a new book, What Wars Leave Behind, The Faceless and the Forgotten, that chronicles his travels to war zones across the globe. Malcolm Garcia tells the stories of the victims of conflict and how their lives are altered long after the media and the soldiers and the profiteers have moved on. This is grim stuff, but it's absolutely essential reminder of the type of havoc that wars cause in the lives of regular folks. Malcolm Garcia's new book, again, is What Wars Leave Behind. He was last on this show in 2009. And Malcolm, welcome back. I can't believe it's been that long. You there, Malcolm?
Talk to you.
Yeah, there you are. There you are. Well, welcome back to the show, Malcolm. So good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I want to go to a place you write about in this book, Malcolm. It's a hospital in Chad near the Sudanese border. This is 2006, and you are given a quick tour. And this is pretty tough stuff as you describe it here in the book. And this is what you write. The soles of my boots stick to the floor. Flies collect on discarded bandages. Women sit outside dimly lit rooms, impassive to the flies scrambling across their faces. One woman grabs my hand. Her boy, there, on the brown plastic mat where dirty sheets peek out from beneath a mosquito net. That boy, he fell from a tree, fractured his left leg. The cast won't dry in the humidity. Wow. I mean, what else did you see in this place, Malcolm? And this place is, it's called Adre Hospital, if I'm saying that correctly. What else did you come across there?
Well, at the time, there were a lot of gunshot wounds. And as you can tell from the description, you know, the hygiene issue certainly doesn't meet Western standards, and that's not a criticism of the hospital. It's just a situation when an impoverished country is caught up in a war. They're doing, you know, the best that they can, but their best is essentially that they don't have the essentials to provide, in this case, health care. So it was really moving around among, you know, living dead people in just awful conditions, who just, you know, amazingly, you know, their bodies just refused to quit. But there were, you know, just horrible, you know, wounds and other issues of health that were difficult to describe.
You know, you've seen a lot of stuff in your career. You've seen things that I never will. And I'm wondering, even at a moment like that, as an experienced guy who's hardened to a lot of tragedy, how was it for you just personally walking around a place like that?
It's certainly difficult. I can't say I've ever been prepared for that. You know, before I became a reporter, I worked with homeless people, and I thought I'd seen everything in that capacity, from, you know, the street alcoholics and the illnesses they had and their own issues of, you know, cleanliness to drive-by shootings, et cetera. But I don't think I've ever really gotten accustomed to that kind of suffering. I can't anticipate it. But I have to say, you know, every time I've encountered it, it gives me pause. I mean, I have a physical as well as an emotional reaction to it, but I do my best to push past.
Yeah. You know, the Janjaweed was responsible for so much of the chaos in the country that you were visiting there in Africa. Who are the Janjaweed, and what were they doing in Chad?
Well, they're Arab fighters, and they were in support of the Sudan government that was essentially trying to suppress another tribal group within Sudan. A lot of the people, I'm simplifying things obviously, but a lot of the people would flee into Chad, and so they just carried the fight across the border.
And what do they do to people? How do they operate? What kinds of soldiers are they?
Well, in a way, you know, you could compare them to ISIS. I mean, ISIS has certainly stepped up barbarity to a notch, but they just would ride into villages, and I mean literally villages, you know, either mud huts or straw thatched roof kind of villages that one would see on National Geographic, and ride in on horses and just slaughter people. And then they would kidnap children and do the stories that we've heard about in terms of keeping the children and through coercion and drugs and other sorts of things, you know, turned them into child soldiers. So they're definitely a brutal force, and one that we, you know, the photographer and I had to be aware of when we were moving around, because the fighting kept shifting. So you could find yourself on the wrong side of the line at any moment.
You know, Chad has lots of oil, as you write in the book, Malcolm. I mean, you write millions of dollars worth has been pumped out of the country, the country's wells between 2003 and 2006 when you were doing your reporting there. I mean, to what extent have the people of Chad benefited from all that oil underneath their feet?
I can only speak of the time that I was there, but I would certainly say none at all. I mean, the capital of Chad was amazing to me, and that it didn't have one paved street. And when it rained, the flooding was so severe that everything from garbage to dead dogs would go sweeping down the streets, and it would get ankle deep if you were outside at the wrong time. You know, you were essentially caught in a flood. There's absolutely no kind of infrastructure, so it is not going to the people at all.
You know, there's a haze over the different countries and scenes that you describe in the book, Malcolm, and it's a filthy haze of corruption and dust and flies and pain and hunger and thirst. And I found it, you know, mind-numbing at times as I churned through the book, just all the tough stuff that you encountered in your travels. How did you deal with all of that?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. In a way, again, harping back to my work with homeless people, I was somewhat prepared or had a little bit of a background of seeing those kinds of hardships and bureaucratic corruption. But, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, you're there, and you have no choice but to deal with it or leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I just did the best I could to deal with it, but it would exhaust you. I mean, it would just I would have the same kind of mind numbing and physical numbing effects mentally I'm walking through a fog where I have to just force myself to stay focused, because it does sap you.
How long does it take you to sort of come out of that kind of, I'm not sure if the word is stupor or not, but once you return home to the Chicago area where you live, how long does it take you to unwind from all of that?
You know, it takes a while. It's difficult. You're real conscious of things. At least I am real conscious of things like malls and expressways and that sort of thing. So it takes a while. I mean, I think I spent a lot of time walking my dogs by myself early in the morning, just sort of gearing myself up for, you know, life back in a suburb outside Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But you start, you know, coming around again.
Now, you write in the introduction to this book that there's another emotion that you deal with, and that's anger. It's anger about so much of what you find in your travels. And I guess, you know, how could you not be, you know, as I look at all this? But one thing in particular, though, is how the suffering of so many people, as you write here, so easily falls beneath the radar of news coverage. Why is that, and what needs to be done about it, in your view?
Well, I think in part, as reporters, and I should say that, you know, the reporters who are overseas in these areas, you know, for much longer than I am, I mean, they live there and are risking their lives daily, do a phenomenal job. So in no way am I being critical of them, but the nature of breaking news is news. And so people, you know, focus on the event, what ISIS is doing now or what is happening, how, you know, the governments of the Palestinian Authority and Israel are reacting to the bodies of three kidnapped children. And with reduced space and airtime, there isn't a whole lot of room to pause for a moment and say, you know, let me really describe what living here is like, or let me really give you a three-dimensional portrait of an individual who's been affected by war. Certainly there are features on television and print and on radio that that do that, but I think the time-limited nature and the room, the space, however you want to put it, just makes it real difficult. And then we move on, you know, to the next crisis. In a way, that also is the nature of news. So ISIS is a big news now, whereas Ukraine was big news, you know, 6 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the challenge is to find a means not to forget the Ukrainians and the other issues that, you know, were hot news before Ukraine was. And to really, you know, just make the time to portray who these people are. Otherwise, you know, you just read this stuff, and as you said, you get numbed. And if you don't have a sense of who these people are who are suffering, it's hard to care about them because you don't have a visceral sense of who this person is. You're not really invested. You just know intellectually that it's wrong for X number of people to be shot or to be refugees, but you don't have an investment in it.
And clearly the point of your book, What Wars Leave Behind, Malcolm, is to help people invest in something that you find very, very important, and that is, again, this notion of what wars leave behind.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I think it completes a full circle. If we care about what happens to the people that wars do leave behind or that we leave behind when we get involved in a country, it can also, you know, quite frankly, trickle down to our own world here in the United States and begin caring about, you know, who are these people on, you know, Chicago's south side or Kansas City's east side who end up being murder victims all the time. I mean, who really are they? You know, and sort of beginning to demand that we need a sense of who these, you know, people are so that by caring about them, we can care about the issues, the politics that are affecting them.
You know, you write in the book, and again, we're visiting with Malcolm Garcia, a former Star reporter who has since his time in Kansas City has been traveling the globe covering one conflict after another. He has a new book out called What Wars Leave Behind, The Faceless and the Forgotten. He joins us this morning from Chicago. You write this in the book, Malcolm: I am drawn by the waste of human upheaval, the prosthetic leg that may have saved my life, not the thrill of the kill. What do you mean by that?
I'm really interested in the people, just as we were talking about earlier. I'm not particularly interested, and this is sacrilege for a reporter to say, I'm not particularly interested in breaking news. The news, the facts don't interest me as much as the people affected by the facts. So I'm not there to say that I was, you know, in Afghanistan, October 17th, 2001, when the U.S., the coalition in there. I'm there to see what happens to the people on the ground, the people that, you know, that we often don't talk to, the shoeshine kids, the beggar on the street, what have you. I'm interested in those folks, and I'm particularly interested in what their lives are like once the attention is off them.
Our phone number here, if you want to
see their lives haven't changed.
Right. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation with Malcolm Garcia, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. In 2005, you got your first glimpse of the consequences of war when you visited Afghanistan and Kabul. And what you saw there was people wandering the streets and donkeys pulling carts and boys pushing wheelbarrows filled with grinning goat heads. You say that you returned to the States, but you felt lost. And you write this: I couldn't stop thinking about Afghanistan and the vacant stares I had absorbed from people who had lost everything. So I put them out of my mind by returning to Kabul again and again to be among them. Why was that such a powerful urge for you?
It just made a huge impression. I had never seen anything like that. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted to learn more about the people, and I had a sense that there were a lot more stories to tell that I didn't get to, because at that time I was on a daily beat, so I was primarily focused on news. I didn't just get to hang out with people. And I just felt compelled to go back and visit people that I'd gotten to know to really get a sense of their story and what was it like living under the Taliban as best as I could understand it. What was it like before the Taliban and Afghanistan was in a civil war? Just the images of the country there. So, you know, they were like a snatching out of the Bible in terms of how ancient they appeared just really made an impression, and I just wanted to kind of complete the job. I felt that I just had only scratched the surface, and I felt I needed to go back.
You know, you've circled the globe, you know, from hotspots in Central Asia to the Middle East and then to Africa, and I gather that war causes the same destruction no matter where it occurs. But do the cultural distinctions make any difference here, Malcolm? I mean, is one culture or another better able to weather all the ugliness, or is my point just plain silly?
No, I wouldn't say your point is silly. I really didn't see any difference. I mean, other than the obvious, you know, I'm in a different country than I was, what, you know, prior to coming to that country. But I saw the effects are pretty universal, just overwhelming suffering, overwhelming, you know, loss of housing, you know, overwhelming health care issues, employment issues, mental health issues. There was a commonality in all the places I went to, and I found that really, you know, if you didn't have the resources to fend for yourself, you're pretty much as bad off as the next guy, whether you were in Egypt or Afghanistan, Pakistan, or what have you.
And we're talking about people who have been living lives maybe not all that different from so many lives over here. You're talking about, you know, people who have been doctors who suddenly are homeless and everybody else in between. I mean, this is really the level of destruction here, whether it's in Pakistan and the earthquakes or anywhere else. It's just staggering in its scope, at least it was to me.
It is amazing. I mean, you can have, you know, a doctor can really be affected just as much or in a very similar way as, say, you know, a guy who's begging on the street. As much as their lives are different from one another, a certain event creates upheaval that resonates through both their lives.
Yeah.
It may be something as simple as a beggar who has to move on to another area because there's nobody to beg from. It may be that the doctor has lost his clinic, lost his job in a, you know, a third world country where it's real hard to start up again and suddenly finds himself in the situation of the beggar. But everybody across all class lines is affected. It's not as if it just affects one group or another.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Again, our guest, Malcolm Garcia, his new book, What Wars Leave Behind, The Faceless and the Forgotten. Let's go to Florence from Kansas City, Missouri. And Florence, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Garcia. Mr. Garcia, I wanted to ask you a question concerning your book, What Wars Leave Behind. Mr. Garcia, do you see any parallel with the people in this country who have gone through economic crisis and who have lost everything, water being cut off because they can't pay their bill? Do you see a parallel between, in any way, with your books, with what's happening here in America?
Florence, that's a wonderful question. Malcolm, go ahead.
I would say in both cases, you have two groups of people who have experienced an incredible upheaval in their lives that was brought on by nothing that they did, in many cases, referring to the United States. And also you have two groups of people who, if they didn't have the resources before, they're in real bad shape after the event occurs. The difference I would say is that the people is dealing with an upheaval brought on by violence. Another group of people is dealing with an issue brought on primarily by an economic upheaval. Now, certainly in the urban core, there are some real similarities between what we traditionally call war and what we're seeing in terms of violence in our cities. But that's how I would see the issue that you're bringing up.
I hope that helps, Florence.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It opens the door.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Malcolm, in all your travels to all these different war zones, is there one place that maybe haunts you more today than any other place, one place that would qualify as the worst destruction you saw and therefore the plight of the people being the most desperate?
I don't know if there's any one worse place. I know I was profoundly affected in Pakistan when I was visiting a village and I was walking along and people told me that the ground that I was walking on had actually been the roofs of houses and that I was walking across people that they hadn't been able to dig up. So in effect, I was walking across a graveyard that I hadn't realized was a graveyard. And that made a big impression on me, needless to say.
What did that scene look like, Malcolm? Give us a paint a picture for us here so we can you can help us see it.
Well, it was oddly very idyllic. It was on a mountain, and it was green, leafy, thick with trees. A creek was running, you know, far below where I was walking. There was a group of UN people distributing aid, but the homes that were standing didn't appear damaged at all. So at first I thought, what am I even doing here? This is an area that wasn't affected. But then in the process of walking around and talking to people and then having that moment that I just described, I realized just, not only the horrors of the situation, but just how oddly subtle it can be, that you can find yourself walking in a death zone and be completely oblivious to it.
What about the quality of the humanitarian organizations that you would come across in your travels, and what do you make of the work they're doing all across the globe?
The people I worked with, I think, are very similar to social workers, social services workers in the United States. They're doing an incredible job, but they don't have enough resources. And without the politics getting right in these countries, building X number of schools or building X number of, irrigation dams for farm fields isn't going to address the issue of people need jobs, people need to trust their government. They need a government that works for them. And what all too often happens is that the people that the aid agencies help become very dependent on the aid organization. So in a sense, you have a government within a government. You have the country's government, then you have the bureaucracy of the various aid organizations, which are working among people who become very dependent upon them, and then are at a loss when the aid organization has to pull out.
You've learned to navigate through some incredibly dangerous places. What's the key to dealing with police and authorities in war zones like you've had to deal with, Malcolm?
Well, I talk to people who've been there before who can give me a heads up about the police and military authorities, try to find a fixer and or a translator who has dealt with them before so that you're not just floundering by yourself as somebody who's completely green when it comes to dealing with them. And then just being, very respectful. Every thought that goes through your head that you really want to say to that guy, you till you get home and have a beer or something, because you're not gonna win arguing. You just have to bend over backwards and suck it up and take what they say and hope you can get around it.
Are you constantly on edge when you make these trips? I mean, constantly in danger, or at least feeling that way?
No, it's odd. You're in a situation where obviously it's violent. There's a war going on. But sometimes, you don't see the war. My idea of war was there'd be combat and shooting in the streets. And, very rarely have I actually seen that. You see kind of a skewed sense of normalcy going on. So it's actually just the reverse. You can actually find yourself being lulled and thinking, well, this isn't really so bad after all. It's and you have to force yourself to stay on your toes, because beneath what seems like everything is fine, there's quite a bit of turmoil and risk.
Let's go back to some phone calls, and Rick from Lawrence. Again, Rick, you're on with Malcolm Garcia, his new book, What Wars Leave Behind. Good morning, Rick.
Hi, Malcolm. Thanks for taking my call. My question has more to do with the media environments environment in the places you've been. I served in both the Balkans and Afghanistan, and I've done a lot of reading on the history of what led to some of these conflicts, and it seems like one of the common denominators that we always see leading up to these conflicts is some pretty dehumanizing media coverage, especially in sectarian conflicts. And I've noticed some of the same elements popping up in American media. There are certain political talk shows that really seem to stoke the sentiment of revolution these days here in America, dehumanizing one group over another. I wanted to get your thoughts on the comparisons between some of the places you've been and what you've seen going on here. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, Rick, thank you. Malcolm, go ahead.
Well, and if I understand the question correctly, I think you have to approach all situations being aware of your biases. So if you go to Afghanistan or whatever, and you have to be aware of what opinions you hold, and you have to be willing to have those opinions challenged, not only willing, but have them challenged by seeking people out who will challenge them, so that you don't fall into a trap of writing a story that's really kind of skewed to your own editorial viewpoint. So, you know, particularly in Afghanistan, where I've been back a lot and I've, you know, formed some opinions, I'm always, you know, making myself aware of those opinions, the conclusions I've reached, and doing my best not to allow those to cloud my judgment, or to you know, not really listen to people who are talking to me, because they might counter those opinions. It's our job to weigh all opinions and just be aware of the ones that we hold and conscious of having to push those to the side.
Yeah, as a reporter, Malcolm, is it tough getting into the places that you want to cover, these places that have been so heavily damaged by war or a natural disaster of one kind or another?
You know, knock on wood, it hasn't been so far. You know, as long as you can get a visa, you can pretty much get into the place. I mean, a place like Syria, we had to drive into. We couldn't fly into. But even Chad, as you know, run down as it was, there was one flight once a week out of Paris to Chad. So really, as long as you can get a visa, you can pretty much get in. Pakistan is difficult. They don't appreciate it if you write stories that are critical of the Pakistan government. So they can drag out the visa process for quite a while. But so far, I haven't had a problem. Now, in Syria, we obviously didn't get a visa. We drove in from Turkey and hooked up with people who knew the FSA and rode around with them.
You know, in Afghanistan, you went into the mountains to interview cave dwellers who had been, you know, displaced by the fighting. Who were these people, and what did you see?
They were the Hazara people, and at that time, this is 2002, you know, they and the Taliban were, you know, just brutal enemies, and the Taliban had certainly slaughtered, you know, hundreds of Hazara people. And so we were in Bamiyan, in a province that's primarily Hazara, and at that time, people were living literally in caves. And they had carpets on the floor of their caves. They had, you know, wall hangings. They had made it as much of a house as possible. Hmm. But they were in caves, and it was brutal in the winter because it was just frigid, no matter the campfires they made. And in the summer, you know, it was quote-unquote pleasant simply because caves are cool, and Afghanistan can get up to 102. So, but they were just living these real – I mean, talk about the effects of war. They were living these primitive lives, or they had to literally resort to caves and very, you know, steep mountains to survive. And again, that was in 2002. They're not in caves now.
Yeah. Malcolm, let's end with this. When you came off the mountain there in Afghanistan, you returned to a building that was providing rooms for the staff of a Belgian humanitarian aid organization, and you were staying with them. You came across an Afghan man who was working for this group. Tell us about him and what he wound up showing you.
He was, in effect, you know, a maintenance worker, a janitor, just cleaning the hall. And I'm not really sure why, but he noticed me, and he started taking me around the building that we're in, and through the help of a translator and so forth, he indicated names on the doors that were written in Arabic, I believe. And they're the names of Taliban commanders. If this had been a Taliban headquarters. So we went through and he just read the names to me. And then at the very end, in just sort of a moment of contrast, the AR organizer started playing a cassette of music, and they were dancing in the hall. And he looked at me, the man, and he put my hand against his wrist, which had was just welted from torture that the Taliban had committed against him. And he just looked at me, and I had the impression that he, you know, after showing me the names on the door, he was showing me, you know, his injuries as a way of trying to make me understand what had happened in that country. And I leave the book with that anecdote because it haunts me still. I never quite knew what to make of it, but it made a profound impression when I pressed my hands against his injuries, his scars, in effect.
Malcolm Garcia's new book is What Wars Leave Behind, The Faceless and the Forgotten. And Malcolm, you know, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And by all means, keep going, man. You're writing important stories, and it's always important for us to have you on the show. And I sure appreciate you taking some time.
Thanks again, Steve. Good talking to you.
You bet. All the best, Malcolm.